Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. This is Bill Redway and I'm bringing you the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday, 16th of March 2019. This week's music is courtesy of the Karavik sisters, two young women from Bath who play the most delightful bluegrass and old-timey American music. This is one of their own compositions and is called Crate 223, and it's from their CD, 10 Years Live. As usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the Hearts Advertiser, the edition published on the 14th of March, and we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days. Courtesy of Sue, once again. In part two, we have a story from Hearts Life magazine about Welwyn Film Studios. It's titled Welwyn Rock, because much of the film Brighton Rock was filmed there and in the surrounding countryside, not as you might expect in and around Brighton. We start with the news, and our readers today are Elizabeth, Jenny, Anna, and Kelly.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth, and my first story is titled Local Plan is Pushed Ahead. St Albans' controversial local plan has seen no substantial changes following the most recent public consultation. The document outlines where 15,000 new houses will be built across the district in the period up to 2036 and has already been subject to two public consultations. There are numerous points of contention. Much of the land sacrificed to development is classified as Green Belt, in Redbourne Ward and near the boundary with Decorum Borough Council. Additionally, one of the new settlements is on land which already has planning permission for a strategic rail freight interchange, SRFI. In the midst of this opposition, the document went out for a second consultation last year. But despite feedback, there have been no changes to the document. In a report to the St Albans District Council, SADC, Planning Policy Committee, PPC, officers have now recommended it is submitted to the Secretary of State. They highlighted that the government has intervened in the local plans of both Wirral Council and Thanet District Council after those authorities took too long in making a submission. The chairman of Redbourne Parish Council, Councillor David Mitchell, has condemned the plan as unsound. He said, "If you look at the responses to Regulation 19, second consultation, there is a lot of criticisms of the local plan, and very little of it seems to have been addressed. It has been noted, but not addressed. I do not think St Albans has been negligent in trying to get a plan through. Where they have done a poor job is in terms of the plan itself. I think the plan is unsound, but I appreciate that they are trying to get something through, and it seems they have thrown it together." He described the document as unfair on Redbourne. Councillor Mitchell added, "I just think it is ridiculous that St Albans wants to build all this housing next to Hemel Hempstead, providing housing for people in Hemel Hempstead, but not for people in St Albans. And people are meant to be walking to work now. I think they have rushed to get everything ready by March, but without considering all the issues. It is meeting housing targets rather than the needs of the community, and so I believe it is unsound." SRFI developers Helio Slough, now SEGRO, have threatened to take legal action if SADC continues to pursue the Park Street Garden Village site, as it is doing in this latest version of the plan. A SEGRO spokesperson said, "We are disappointed that the draft local plan, to be submitted by SADC, continues to fail to recognise the importance of the SRFI at Radlett, and the Secretary of State's clear support for its delivery. We will continue to make the case for its development. The SRFI is a nationally important infrastructure project that will play a key role in supporting the government's rail freight strategy, which includes getting more freight off the roads and onto rail, reducing HGV movements and improving air quality. She also stressed that an SRFI at Radlett will create regional and local jobs in a post-Brexit Britain. The land in question is owned by Herts County Council. SADC planning portfolio holder, Councillor Mary Maynard, has defended the decision to leave the document relatively unaltered. She said, "In terms of the big-ticket sites, the main sites, the employment locations, the infrastructure, that is all still there. We went through an analytical approach, and nothing that comes up in the Regulation 19, second consultation, suggested any changes to that. We had no duty to cooperate problems. Everybody was content. Duty to cooperate issues were the downfall of the previous strategic local plan, which was thrown out of High Court in 2017 after councils surrounding the St Albans boundary lodged complaints about a lack of consultation." Councillor Maynard added, "I am hopeful that the SADC Cabinet will agree to the submission. I can't see why not. There is nothing substantially changed to what the council have seen." She stressed that all infrastructure concerns have been considered, including roads, household water provision, GP surgeries and schools, and 4 secondaries and 14 primaries. If both the PCC last night, March 13, and then SADC Cabinet today, March 14, approve the local plan, it will be submitted to the Secretary of State, who will scrutinise the document.
Hello, I'm Jenny. We will not tolerate this kind of offence and will seek to trace those responsible. 2 fly tippers have been ordered to pay £1,000 for dumping unwanted furniture and other material in St Albans. Khalid Mia, 22, of Doggett's Way, St Albans, and Imed Benbala, 48, of Ninian Road, Hemel Hempstead, both admitted dumping the waste at separate locations in the city. Mia left mirrored doors, parts of a wardrobe, carpet underlay and cardboard packaging at the entrance to a building site in Waverley Road. The site foreman reported the fly tip to the council and a resident provided CCTV images. Officers then traced Mia with the help of an address from packaging found at the scene. Mia admitted a breach of the Environmental Protection Act at a St Albans Magistrate Court hearing in August last year. He was fined £320 and ordered to pay compensation of £191, which covered the cost of removing the waste. He was also ordered to pay £220 toward the council's legal costs and a victim surcharge of £32, making a total of £763. Solicitor Oliver Mather, mitigating for Mia, said his client had apologised for his actions and pleaded guilty at the earliest opportunity. Meanwhile, Benbala was caught on CCTV fly-tipping a sack of waste and a cardboard box near some council bins in Drover's Way in December 2017. He was fined £120 and ordered to pay £97 in waste removal compensation and a £30 victim surcharge, making a total of £247. Both fly-tippers were prosecuted at the Magistrates' Court on Wednesday, February 27th. Councillor Francis Leonard, portfolio holder for the Environment, said, "Fly-tipping is an antisocial crime that spoils the landscape and costs the council significant sums to clear up. These successful prosecutions show we will not tolerate this kind of offence and will seek to trace those responsible and take action against them. In the case of the building site fly-tip, I would like to thank both the site foreman for reporting it to us and the resident who captured the incident on CCTV and gave us the evidence. This is an example of how the council needs to work together with the community to deter the crime of fly tipping by tracing offenders and prosecuting them.
Well, hello, I'm Anna. And my first piece is entitled Airport Expansion Causes Serious Traffic Concerns for Towns and Villages. Luton Airport's expansion plans are anticipated to cause serious problems on the roads, according to Herts County Council. The airport is planning to expand to accommodate 32 million passengers per year, which has led to concerns from campaigners in St Albans and Harpenden about the impact of noise pollution on residents. Herts County Council has identified ensuring sustainable transport links to and from the airport as its key challenge to mitigate the pollution and traffic congestion caused by people travelling by car. Derek Ashley, Cabinet Member for Growth, Infrastructure, Planning and Economy, said, like many others who responded to London Luton Airport Limited's informal consultation last year, we continue to have serious concerns about the impact of aircraft noise on nearby towns and villages. And we're also concerned about how an extra 14 million passengers a year will actually get to the airport without this causing serious problems on Hertfordshire's roads. With up to 100,000 new homes expected to be built in Herts over the next 15 years, we're already expecting a 20% increase in traffic on our roads if we don't take action. We need to make sure that the airport has proper, sustainable transport plans that encourage people travelling to and from the airport to use more sustainable options such as bus and rail. Chair of the airport councillor Andy Malcolm said, in our judgment, targeting growth to 32 million passengers per year is the right choice at this stage to help us move towards making the best use of our existing single runway in line with government policy and getting the balance right between delivering economic benefits and managing environmental impacts. It remains our assessment and aspiration that London Luton Airport can deliver a maximum capacity of 36 to 38 million passengers per year in the longer term. Noise and surface access were two of the key issues raised by respondents to our first public consultation last summer, and our technical advisers are already working closely with a wide range of stakeholders, including Herts County Council, to make sure that our evolving strategies to minimise and mitigate impacts will be the best they can be. And there's a picture of a Wizz, that's the name of the aeroplane, coming in to land at Luton Airport, and it looks like it's landing in beautiful fields and countryside, but obviously it isn't.
My name is Kelly. My article is titled, We Have to Be Grateful That No One Was Hurt and the Car Didn't Blow Up, Says Motorist. A couple watched in terror as their car suddenly burst into flames outside their St Albans home. At about 8:30 a.m. on Sunday, February the 24th, Steph Harvey set out to take their dog to agility classes, turning on the demister of her Vauxhall Sephira B to clear the windscreen. Almost immediately, she saw smoke coming from the heating vents and switched the engine off. But this did not resolve the problem, with smoke starting to pour from the car and crackling fire noises coming from the footwell. Enlisting the help of her husband, Richard, they emptied the car of their possessions and called Herts Fire and Rescue Service on 999. Richard said, at this stage, the panic set in. My wife grabbed a kitchen fire extinguisher. I was absolutely terrified. The fire brigade just said, get away from the car and keep people away from it while they got there. A blaze soon enveloped the vehicle, which is now written off. Steph and Richard were unaware that the Sephira B model had been recalled by Vauxhall. Richard said, from what I understand, they would send out a letter to the owner at the time of the recall to be fixed free of charge, though they do not inform subsequent owners if any of these are outstanding. The second recall was never applied to our car. ITV reported that Vauxhall was investigating 161 Zafara B fires in 2015. But by 2018, the company was recalling 47,000 models. Richard added, "I was quite emotional, quite annoyed. We had only had the car about a year. We had just spent a lot of money on it. In the 2 weeks previous, they had forked out about £1,200 on an MOT, service, engine maintenance and tyres." He added, "We have to be grateful that no one was hurt and the car didn't blow up." A spokesperson from Vauxhall said it takes safety very seriously. Through continual testing, Vauxhall has launched a recall of some Vauxhall Zafira models to replace the heater blower, motor and regulator. These are the second generation models Zafira B, built between 2005 and 2014. In agreement with the DVSA, we have written to owners using the keeper's address data from the DVLA, advising them to contact a Vauxhall retailer to arrange to have the work carried out free of charge. However, it is important to note that the incident reported here may not be related to the recall, and until Vauxhall has investigated this specific case, it cannot make any comment.
There's a lovely photograph of a fire engine for a story entitled Fire Control 999 Calls Diverted for 12 Hours Due to Network Issue. Hart's Fire and Rescue Service's control room had to divert 999 calls for 12 hours after a network issue last month. An inside source, who worked for the service for more than 30 years, told us that the control centre based at the Longfield site in Stevenage's Hitchin Road was being affected by an unknown issue with their dispatching system. From late afternoon on February the 11th, the Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service control centre in Stevenage was in total shutdown due to an unknown problem with the notoriously unreliable Vision 4 system, our source said. Even Hart stations were unable to call the control on the landlines and had to remain on radio watch throughout the night as the turnout systems for the stations were in an unknown state of operation. Norfolk Fire Control took over running the entire 999 system for the service as per the replanned contingency. The Hearts Fire and Rescue Service confirmed that the control room was unable to accept emergency calls for half a day, but said the Vision 4 system was not to blame. A spokeswoman said, "Our fire control centre in Stevenage was unable to accept 999 calls for approximately 12 hours last month due to a network issue, which also affected other users. This was nothing to do with our Vision 4 mobilising system. As you would expect, we have robust contingency plans in place for incidents such as these, which worked as planned, and as such, 999 calls were handled by our colleagues in Norfolk. We would like to reassure people that public safety was not compromised during this time. All incoming 999 calls were received, and our fire engines were still able to be mobilised. It's not the first time the Longfield control room has had IT problems. In January last year, another inside source told this newspaper that they would routinely spend 4 or 5 hours every day trying to get into the control room computer systems. I absolutely believe that the lack of faith in the system when we go out to a job is putting lives in danger, they said. These claims were refuted by a Hearts County Council spokesman who said, "While these issues are frustrating for both HFRS fire control and operational crews, they are not preventing us from delivering an effective emergency response."
Rennie Grove will help widen people's access to hospices. Rennie Grove Hospice Care is joining forces with other hospices across the UK to support a new campaign aimed at widening access to the vital support they provide for people with life-limiting conditions and those who care for them. The Open Up Hospice Care campaign, which launched on the 4th of March and is led by National Hospice and Palliative Care Charity Hospice UK, highlights how hospice care is available beyond hospice inpatient units, including in people's homes. One in four people in the UK miss out on the care they need, according to the earlier research by the national charity, for a range of reasons including a lack of or late referrals to hospice services and low levels of awareness about hospice care and where and when the support is available. Also, studies have shown that people from economically deprived areas, black and minority ethnic communities, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people can experience barriers to accessing end-of-life care services. Hospice UK and local hospices are working to tackle this through initiatives to extend care to more people, such as expanding community services and reaching out to the different groups of people who have been missing out on vital support, including those caring for their loved ones at home. At Rennie Grove, all care is delivered in patients' homes or in day services, which helps overcome some of the barriers that people have to accessing hospice care. However, increasing awareness about Rennie Grove services and encouraging referrals at an earlier stage is a focus for the future. Earlier referrals will enable everyone to plan better for the end of life, avoid unnecessary hospital admissions, and ultimately benefit from a better end-of-life experience. Through initiatives such as the Volunteer Supporting Hands service, Rennie Grove is also offering both patients and carers more practical support with aspects of daily living they are finding hard. Stuart Marks, Chief Executive at Rennie Grove Hospice Care, explained, "We are pleased to be part of this campaign and hope that it helps bust some of the commonly held myths around hospice care. Hospice care is not just about providing beds for the dying. It's about empowering people to choose to live well throughout their illness, which may be for many years. We know we can make a real difference if we have enough time to work with people. So by encouraging earlier referrals, we hope to ensure that we will give the very best care to our local community."
Sustainability Festival boasts its biggest ever schedule for 2019. A popular sustainability festival is boasting a record number of events in 2019. More than 130 events are lined up for the jam-packed St Albans Sustainability Festival schedule, which will take place from May the 11th to June the 1st. There will be walks in local nature spots, vegan food demonstrations, talks on sustainable fashion and green investment, cycle rides, allotment open days, litter picks, and even a free community sports day organised by Nuffield Health. Chair of the Sustainable Festival organising group, Catherine Ross, said, "We have been bowled over by the number of groups eager to put on an event as part of this year's three-week Sustain Fest 19. There is a jam-packed programme, and we hope the events will give residents inspiration and information about living sustainably. We're inviting everyone to join in, have fun, and make changes." St Albans Sustainability Festival is organised by the charity Sustainable St Albans alongside St Albans Friends of the Earth. One of the festival organisers, Gail Jackson, said, "Most of the sponsors will be running their own sustainable events during the festival. By being at the heart of the festival, in addition to offering their sponsorship, they really show how much they support sustainability in our community, and we are extremely grateful to them all." Sponsors include ACOM, Affinity Water, Christopher Place Shopping Centre, Hearts County Show, Lussmann's, Aylett's Nurseries, Green Angel Syndicate, Mama Bamboo and St Albans BID, which is specifically supporting a market takeover. The Hearts advertiser is media partner. The market takeover event will see St. Peter's Street lined with stalls, music, entertainment and food. St. Albans Bid manager Helen Burridge said, "I'm delighted to announce St. Albans Bid's sponsorship of the market takeover event as part of the festival. It is important for all St. Albans businesses to consider issues around sustainability and the environment, and this will be a great day for everyone to focus on this aspect of the city's life. The full events programme will be available from April the 5th.
Extinction Rebellion sets up shop in the city. Science is clear on global catastrophe. An environmental activist group which is rapidly gaining momentum around the UK has set up a new branch in St Albans. Extinction Rebellion, or referred to as XR, aimed to drive radical governmental change through the non-violent resistance and protests in order to slow or halt climate change. The group has made national headlines by blocking traffic through the centre of London at rush hour, causing long queues and angering commuters. 9 Extinction Rebellion members were recently arrested after gluing themselves to the front of a central London hotel. There are now about 150 Extinction Rebellion groups all over the country. The St Albans branch are kicking off their campaign by hosting a talk called Heading for Extinction, bracket, and what to do about it, bracket. Members also gathered outside St Albans Cathedral to make the Extinction Rebellion logo, which is pictured. Flamsted resident Dr Emily Spry, who has 2 young daughters, joined the St Albans group. She said, "The science is clear, but the politicians aren't doing enough and we need to let them know how worried people are about what is happening to our planet." Dr Spry said that a tipping point is fast approaching, where lack of ice in the sea leads to further warming that cannot be stopped by reducing the use of fossil fuel. The UK just enjoyed an uncharacteristically warm February, with Rothamsted Research reporting that winter sunshine over St Albans district totaled 137.7 hours and the average maximum temperature was the highest in that month since records began. Scientists at the famous lab say it was the second sunniest February overall since 1891. In December last year, the BBC reported that well-known nature documentary maker Sir David Attenborough described global warming as humanity's greatest threat in thousands of years. He said it could lead to civilization collapse and the extinction of much of the natural world. St Albans Extinction Rebellion talk will be held from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. on March 12th at Trinity United Reformed Church on Beaconsfield Road.
Celebrating 5 years of local heroes. An initiative to celebrate the valiant heroes of the St Albans community is back for its 5th year. Whether it's someone who has lent a neighbourly hand, taken it upon themselves to help clear out the streets of rubbish, or raise thousands of pounds for charity, their story is worth being heard. The Maltings Community Heroes campaign will run from March until August, and each of these months the shopping centre will be awarding £100 to spend in their stores for one of these heroes. To enter, simply email your story to communityhero@heartsad.co.uk, including the name of the nominee, their contact details, and your name and contact details. Centre manager Phil Corrigan said, "It's difficult to believe that we are now entering the 5th year of the Maltings Community Hero Awards, but we are, and following the success of the previous 4 years, we are really looking forward to it. We met so many astonishing people, both young and old, all dedicated to helping and supporting individuals and organisations within the local community. We want to do all we can to help draw attention to their outstanding work and commitment and assist in promoting the charities and community groups in St Albans as much as possible. The Community Heroes Awards mean we can do just that every month. so it is with great pleasure to announce that not only are we running the Maltings Community Heroes Award again, but we are also sponsoring the Hearts Advertiser Community Awards and the Maltings Community Heroes category for the fifth year running. The Hearts Advertiser Community Awards will launch officially in April and celebrate the achievements of our local unsung heroes. There will once again be 12 categories to choose from, and you will be able to nominate people for these online. The overall winner of last year's Maltings Community Heroes category was Neil Jordan Cause, a member of the support team at Heathland School for Deaf Children, where he often helps those with additional learning or physical needs. He is the chair of the PTA at Heathlands and is at the forefront of any fundraising activities. Neil also runs an after-school football club in collaboration with St Albans City Deaf Youth FC, where he has undertaken training as a coach to ensure access for deaf children. And there's a lovely picture of last year's community heroes holding their awards.
This article is entitled Short Film. A sixth former from St Albans won the award for Best Short Film at the BFI Future Film Festival. Saul Lotsoff, who's in the upper sixth at St Albans School, won the award for his film Milk Bottle, which portrays a father taking his son out on a seemingly innocent pheasant shoot, which becomes distorted. He said, "I was thrilled about being in the official selection for the BFI Future Film Festival, let alone being nominated for an award. Most filmmakers' objectives with their shorts is to get them into as many official selections as possible, but I'd never dreamt of winning an award at my first attempt." Saul gave a speech at the award ceremony and received a £1,000 cash prize. His film will also be screened at the Beverly Hills Film Festival at the beginning of April. St Albans School Headmaster Jonathan Gillespie said, "Saul's film shows incredible talent at such an early age." And there is a picture here of the delighted young man, Saul.
Discover Town's latest cafe next to the park. And this is written by the local foodie, she calls herself. Have you found the new Park Cafe in Harpenden yet? It's in a lovely location overlooking pretty Rutherford Park, just behind the Sports Centre. Although part of the new Pegasus retirement development, it is very much open to everyone, and I think as the weather continues to improve will be very popular. It's perfect for anyone using the park. It is the most beautiful cafe. Spacious and light, with floor-to-ceiling windows that can be opened in the summer, so the cafe and terrace will be one open space. I love the exposed concrete look and funky lighting. It is definitely one of the smartest and most Instagrammable cafes in the area, a striking departure from traditional retirement home styling. The kitchen is open so you can see the chefs at work, and I spotted a pizza oven. And on Saturday, I went in, pizzas were very popular, especially with the young families having lunch. The sourdough pizza menu had some unusual options, including souvlaki chicken, sirloin steak, and one with butternut squash, aubergine and mozzarella. And there is a margarita option on the kids' menu too. You can even get a breakfast pizza topped with bacon, beans, mushrooms and egg. I think the lunch and small to large plate menu has some delicious options, such as salmon fillet with caper burnt lemon, roasted new potatoes and broccoli, king prawns with chilli and lime, and roasted butternut gnocchi. My salad with avocado, cherry vine tomatoes, tofu and couscous was well presented and generous, and you can add chicken or salmon as well. Prices for main courses are in the £10 to £18 range, so more than you might expect from a cafe, but in keeping with the gastropubs in the area, and the main courses were generous in size and good quality. You can also get hearty sandwiches with interesting fillings such as fish goujon, pulled pork and pulled jackfruit, as well as a classic BLT or cheese and ham panini. They all come with vegetable crisps and a side salad. Breakfast looks good too, with waffles, buttermilk pancakes, smoothies, sausage sandwiches and granola with yogurt. The warm banana and chocolate chip bread with cinnamon ricotta sounds amazing. You're also very welcome to just pop in for a coffee at any time. And my Americano was excellent, as was my gluten-free lemon cake. There's a more informal seating area near the kitchen, which is perfect for a quick coffee break. I was interested to hear that there are discussions about what to do about the huge evergreen trees lining the path right outside the cafe. At the moment, they do block the view of the park, but also offer shade and privacy. It will be interesting to see if they stay or go. Park Cafe is open every day, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m, Sundays 9 a.m. to 4 p.m, and offers breakfast, lunch and through to afternoon tea and cakes. I love that Park Cafe is open to anyone, including, of course, residents in the retirement flats. It makes it buzzy and vibrant. When I went in, there were groups of friends, families with young children, someone working on a laptop and dog walkers. It's a short walk from the town centre if you cut through by busy Bee's Nursery, and there's a little parking if you need it, although you do need to register your car with the staff so you don't get a ticket. It's a fab new addition to Harpenden, and I'm sure will be very popular. And actually, I'm drooling at the mouth now.
Tributes to disabled activist, my world, strength, friend, brother, inspiration. Tributes have been paid to a well-loved St Albans activist who campaigned tirelessly for disabled people's rights. Glenn Shorey passed away in hospital at 25 years old on the night of January the 26th, surrounded by friends and family. He was diagnosed at just 9 years old with Friedreich's ataxia, a rare genetic condition that causes degenerative nervous system damage and movement problems. The condition meant Glenn had an enlarged heart, a symptom which eventually led to his passing. At the initial diagnosis, doctors gave Glenn only 21 years, but he did not let that hold him back, creating a blog called The Adventures of a Wheelchair Boy. He started to campaign for disabled people's rights in St Albans and beyond. On one occasion, Glenn focused his attention on accessibility at train stations after he experienced multiple difficulties using public transport. He was forced to travel via Luton on his way back to St Albans from London just because Thameslink train lifts were faulty. When St Albans District Council concreted cyclist speed humps on a cycle path leading to King Harry Lane, which were too high for wheelchair users, Glenn succeeded in forcing the authority to remove them. As an Arsenal Football Club fan, Glenn also visited every Premier League stadium in the country to make sure they had wheelchair access. The former Sandringham school pupil also raised just over £4,200 for Great Ormond Street Hospital with a sponsored skydive. Glenn's sister Rachel said, "I am honoured and grateful to have called you my brother. We had such amazing times together and you taught me so much. You were my world, my strength, my friend, my brother, my advisor and my inspiration, and there are not enough words in the world to thank you for being such an amazing brother. You will always be in my heart, and I know you will always be with me until the day we meet again." She said Glenn, who had lived independently in New Greens for the last 2 years, was positive and determined to make the world a better place without letting his disability define him. For someone who was dealt a bad hand, he lived the most independent life that he could and was aware that there are people who weren't as lucky as him. A memorial was held at Sandringham School in February. There's a photo of Glenn Shorey with his father and Sandra Stellan, a support teacher at Sandringham School.
And more about Glenn. His masseuse and yoga teacher is climbing Everest in memory of her friend and to raise money for charity. Lucy Hurley is scaling the world's tallest mountain in aid of Ataxia UK, a national charity which supports people with the incurable condition. The trip, which will take place from September the 26th to October the 13th, is organised by Charity Challenge. Lucy, who lives in Redbourne, said, "Not many people know what ataxia is. Not many people have heard of it because it is quite a rare condition, but it is quite horrific. There is no cure, it is degenerative, and I wanted to do this to help bring awareness and help families who are affected." Lucy met Glenn after switching careers to work in sports and remedial massage. She taught him wheelchair yoga every week for a year. She said, "Glenn was a friend, he made me laugh, he gave me advice, he was so caring and thoughtful and an absolute comedian." And you can donate to Lucy's Climb at uk.virginmoneygiving, which is all one word, .com/Lucy Hurley. That's L-U-C-Y, capital H-U-R-L-E-Y.
Stellar soloist lineup joins Choral Society. St Albans Choral Society will perform Bach's St John's Passion in the Cathedral next weekend. You can listen to the leading amateur choir at the Abbey on Saturday, March the 23rd. The Choral Society will be joined by a stellar lineup of soloists, including tenor Mark Dobell as Evangelist and St Albans-based bass baritone Edward Grint as Christus. The Passion, Johann Sebastian Bach's first musical setting of the events leading to Christ's crucifixion, was first heard nearly 300 years ago on Good Friday, 1724. More intense than its later sister piece, the St Matthew Passion, the St John is full of colour and emotional depth. Exquisite solo arias and chorales allow space for contemplation in Bach's almost operatic treatment of Christ's Passion. But increasingly the story moves at breakneck pace, propelled by the chorus giving full force to the visceral urgency, anger, betrayal and sorrow of the biblical texts. Combining high drama and introspection with some of the most experimental music Bach composed, the St. John has transcended time and place to become one of the greatest works of all Western classical music. St. Albans Choral Society will perform in the original German, with the accompanying Orchestra Nova under conductor George Fass and six soloists. Soloist Mark Dobell is a member of the 16 and the Westminster Abbey Choir. Edward Grint, a graduate of the International Opera School at the Royal College of Music, won praise for the nobility and youth of his Christ in a previous performance of The Passion. The other soloists are soprano Kirsty Hopkins, Welsh mezzo-soprano Rebecca Afonwe-Jones, tenor Greg Tassel, and baritone Felix Kemp. The concert is on Saturday, March the 23rd, and starts at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available from the gift shop, St Albans Cathedral, by telephoning 01727 890 290. Tickets are priced £10 to £28, with children under 18 and full-time students £5.
More music. This is about a lunchtime recital at St Peter's Church. Cellist Gabriel Yeon and pianist Kaoru Wade will perform next week's free lunchtime recital at St Peter's Church. Their programme for Wednesday, March the 20th, includes Debussy's Cello Sonata and Brahms' Cello Sonata in F. Gabriel began her musical education as a junior student of Professor Ray Wang at the Hong Kong Academy for Performing Arts. She later studied with Richard May at Wells Cathedral School. As a scholarship recipient at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London, she's now currently studying with Rebecca Gulliver, the cello principal of the London Symphony Orchestra. Born in Japan, Kaoru Wade is a London-based pianist with a diverse career as a performer and teacher. She is a visiting piano tutor and accompanist at Eton College. The music starts at 1 p.m. with donations in aid of Grove House Hospital. And Maria Otaka, pianist, and Joel Williams, tenor, will perform at St. Peter's Church on March the 27th. World-renowned tribute act The Bootleg Beatles comes to the St. Alban Arena for two performances on Friday, March the 22nd, and Saturday, March the 23rd. The Fab Four copyists continue to draw critical acclaim with their stunning recreation of the greatest songbook of all time, tracing John, Paul, George and Ringo's journey through the swinging 60s. Every tiny detail is meticulously covered, from costumes to authentic period instruments. This year's tour features a special set celebrating the 50th anniversary of The White Album, which included tracks such as Back in the USSR, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, Helter Skelter and Obladi Oblada. With a little help from their own Pepperland Sinfonia, the Bootleg Beatles concert will be a fab event for fans of all ages, and tickets cost £32.50.
Garden Waste. A new garden waste service is being launched in St Albans to help householders recycle excess material. Currently, St Albans District Council's waste contractor, Veolia, can only empty one green wheelie bin or two reusable bags at each property. However, under the new scheme, residents will be able to pay an annual subscription to have up to three extra bins or six reusable bags, which are available in conservation areas, emptied during the normal collection. The new service, which costs £50 a year per bin or reusable bag, is primarily aimed at people with large gardens who produce above average amounts of cut grass, hedge clippings and similar waste. Anyone wanting to take part in the new garden waste scheme can sign up by creating a My St Albans account on the council's website.
Talking newspaper radio listings. From Saturday the 16th of March to Friday the 22nd of March. For Saturday the 16th of March, on Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m, Simon Russell Beale plays George Smiley and heads a stellar cast, including Kenneth Cranham, Anna Chancellor and Eleanor Bron, in this radio dramatisation of John le Carré's first novel, Call for the Dead. In Saturday Night at the Movies, on Classic FM at 5 p.m, Andrew Collins takes a break from the big screen for a one-off celebration of TV music. Classic FM is joining forces with Radio Times to launch a poll of the nation's favourite themes. Featured music are themes from Inspector Morse, Downton Abbey, Foyle's War and The New Poldark. Archive on 4 on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. is Polling Badly. Sarah Smith explores the 1980s poll tax and its effect on the government of Margaret Thatcher, whilst examining the current universal credit and its flaws. She talks to key figures from the 1980s, including William Waldegrave, Michael Heseltine, Margaret Hodge and David Blunkett. For Sunday the 17th of March, at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is the author Marlon James, whose 2014 novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, won the Man Booker Prize. At 6:45 p.m. on Radio 3, Sunday Feature follows Gabriel Prokofiev, a composer, promoter and DJ who visits Moscow to find out what life was like for his father Oleg, an abstract painter, and for his grandfather, Sergei, one of the most celebrated composers of the 20th century. Following that, at 7:30 p.m, Drama on 3 is Leave Taking, a radio adaptation of Winsome Pinnock's 1988 superb play featuring the cast from the 2018 revival. Jamaican-born Enid takes her teenage daughters to the local Abaya woman for some traditional Caribbean healing. They learn far more about each other than they ever expected. But is it magic or simply facing up to reality?
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. At 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 FM, the book of the week is Cherry Ingram, The Englishman Who Saved Japan's Blossoms. Hattie Morahan reads Japanese journalist Naoko Abe's book about Collingwood, a.k.a. Cherry, Ingram, 1880 to 1981, who dedicated most of his very long life to the cultivation and preservation of Japan's ancient cherry blossoms. At 12 midday on Radio 3, composer of the week is Astor Piazzolla, 1921 to 1992, who was a virtuoso of the bandoneon and dedicated his life to raising the profile of this instrument and the tango. At 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4, Nick Robinson returns with a new series of Political Thinking, in which leading figures talk about their political beliefs. Mabinogi is a fantasy adventure on Radio 3 at 10:45 p.m. It is adapted by Lucy Catherine from the tales of the medieval Welsh mythology that form the earliest prose stories of Britain.
And some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday the 18th of March, for its series of The Conversation at 11:30 a.m. and repeated at 11:30 p.m. on BBC World Service, Women and Self-Defence explores the impact that learning self-defence can have on women. Two teachers of self-defence techniques from different parts of the world speak to presenter Celia Hutton about their experiences of physically empowering women. On Radio 4 at 11 p.m, The Walk Across the Water is the first of two episodes of a poignant documentary comparing two towns of historic importance. The first is about Dover and Calais, both having much in common. Cole Morton interviews an Afghan refugee granted asylum in the UK and the fisherman who rescues refugees from their sinking dinghy. On Tuesday, the 19th of March, Jim Al-Khalili's guest on The Life Scientific at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 is Corinne Lecour, Professor of Climate Change Science at the University of East Anglia and head of the Global Carbon Project, which works to slow down and ultimately stop the increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. On a similar subject, rural affairs correspondent Tom Heap, who appears on BBC's Country File, investigates the link between childhood asthma and pollution in Costing the Earth on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Radio 3, In Concert at 7:30 p.m, is a concert given earlier this month from Newport in Wales by the youthful Welsh Chamber Orchestra Sinfonia Cymru. The added attraction is the appearance of celebrated young cellist Sheku Canny Mason, fresh from his performances at last year's Royal Wedding and the Royal Variety Show. On Wednesday, 20th of March, at 8 p.m. on Classic FM, Jane Jones presents the Full Works Concert, and to mark the official start of spring, the selection is devoted to sap-raising classics, including Vivaldi's Spring and Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. At 11 p.m. on Radio 4, Peter Curran and Patrick Marber star in a comedy written by then called Bunk Bed. As the title implies, the two share a bunk bed and talk of all manner of subjects in the darkness. The review warns the listener not to be put off by the slightly morbid ideas as they soon move on to more laughable subjects.
On Thursday, the 21st of March, the film programme on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. features Ralph Fiennes, who talks about his third directorial feature, The White Crow, a biopic of ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev, in which Fiennes plays Alexander Pushkin, St. Petersburg's most respected dance instructor. At 10 p.m. on Radio 3, in Free Thinking, Anne McElvoy looks at three current exhibitions about the challenges facing artists when painting children and is joined by historian Emma Butcher, who is doing research into childhood fears and the trauma of war. On Friday the 22nd of March, universities in England are steeling themselves for a big hit on their finances in order to balance the books. In the University Time Bomb on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, Branwen Jeffries, the BBC's education editor, investigates what this will mean for the future of higher and further education in England. Friday night is Music Night on Radio 2 at 8 p.m, and Grammy-winning singer and songwriter Michael Bolton is in the spotlight tonight. His big hits from the 1980s and 90s are revisited, supported by the BBC Concert Orchestra.
Before we move on, here are the names of people who have died recently, and their ages if published, whose names are recorded in the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. We hope they rest in peace and send condolences to their families. Geoffrey Allen, 100. Margaret Gander, 92. Arthur Sargent. John Chaplin, 74. Winifred Baker, 96. Peter Fuller, 94. And Ian Fulton, 84.
Hello, I'm Andy. This article comes from Hertfordshire Life magazine, November 2018, and has the title Well in Rock. It's a masterpiece of British cinema, but it's a little-known fact that the coastal crime classic Brighton Rock was largely filmed in Hertfordshire. This article, written by Richard Luck, takes up the story on the film's 70th anniversary. Films are rarely shot where you'd imagine. Take Casablanca. The nearest Bogie and Bergman got to North Africa was a visit to Los Angeles' top Moroccan barber. Then there's St. Albans auteur Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, where the Becton Gasworks stood in for war-torn Indochina. Still closer to home, we have the Bolting Brothers' adaptation of Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. 70 years on from its release, the picture that introduced the world to Richard Attenborough has long been considered a classic. But how much of it was shot on the South Coast? Not as much as you'd imagine. Founded in 1928, Wellin Studios had played host to all manner of productions before Messrs. Bolton and Attenborough came along. Wildlife documentaries, Anthony Asquith's The Celestial City and A Cottage on Dartmoor, countless quota quickie bee pictures. The facility's output couldn't have been more eclectic. Come the late 1930s, the studio, located in the heart of the town's industrial quarter on Broadwater Road, started to attract big productions and major movie names. Ralph Richardson, Margaret Lockwood, Maureen O'Hara, local girl Dinah Sheridan, even Hollywood's first Dracula, Bela Lugosi, came to the new Garden City. With Wellin, one of the few studios not to be requisitioned by the government following the outbreak of the Second World War, it continued to thrive throughout the conflict, marking itself out as a genuine threat to its Hearts movie-making neighbour, Elstree. Michael Rennie, Jack Hawkins, James Mason, Michael Wilding, bona fide A-listers were so often seen around Wellin, they ceased to be remarkable. Quite how they spent their downtime, we don't know, but it's rather nice to think of Michael Denison and Dulcie Gray promenading down Parkway while Rex Harrison and Annan Eagle enjoyed a coffee in the Welland department stores before heading back to the set of I Live in Grosvenor Square. With that picture's director, Herbert Wilcox, demonstrating how you could recreate Mayfair in the Home Counties, it's little wonder that John and Roy Bolting felt confident they could conjure up any number of Brighton interiors on the Welwyn lot. It would certainly be a lot easier than filming on location. With their picture telling the story of a young Hood, Attenborough's Pinky Brown, running amok on the south coast, director John and producer Roy had no end of trouble placating the Brighton elders, who feared the film would inspire a copycat crime wave. Things became so problematic that the Boltings took to stealing shots on the streets of the town using hidden cameras. Similar guerrilla tactics were employed when the brothers filmed a scene at the local racetrack. Since the course had been targeted by real-life knife gangs in the 1930s, there was no way the authorities would give the filmmakers the run of the place. That the frantic nature of the shoot only added to the excitement of the sequence is one of those happy accidents that great movies seem to enjoy. In contrast, the Welwyn Studios shoot was positively sedate. Indeed, in the 70 years since the film came out, not a single story has emerged of trouble on the set, of egos clashing, or of the filmmakers struggling to capture their vision. Then again, it does help when your cast comprises actors as talented and professional as Hermione Baddeley, Nigel Stock, Harcourt Williams, and Doctor Who's William Hartnell, who is all but unrecognisable here as the no-good gang member Dallow. And there, at the heart of the piece, is the utterly delightful Richard Attenborough playing the thoroughly wretched Pinky Brown. Hired on the strength of his debut performance in Noel Coward's In Which We Serve, the moon-faced star doesn't look terribly threatening, but that only makes the character all the more unsettling. Attenborough's Pinky mightn't have been the first baby-faced assassin, but that description fits him very well. Impressive as the cast is, it's all but eclipsed by the behind-the-camera talent. Besides Nobel nominee Green adapting his novel in collaboration with future knight Terence Rattigan, the Boltings are as mighty a film force as has ever come out of this country. From thrillers like Brighton Rock and 7 Days to Noon, to comedies such as I'm All Right Jack and Private's Progress, the twins were as prolific as they were versatile. Brighton Rock, however, remains their masterpiece, a film so good as to be untarnished by a raft of movie rip-offs and a misfiring modern-day remake. Upon its release in 1948, the film enraged newspapers and politicians while delighting cinemagoers the length and breadth of the nation. When seen today, it's hard to believe that the relatively tame violence could have made anyone think the country was on the brink of moral collapse. Then again, a lot of things have changed over the last 7 decades. Take Welwyn Studios. With Elstree in the ascendant, the decision was made to shut the lot down and sell it off in 1951. Years later, Polycell took over the facility, filling the old sound stages with machinery and using the Art Deco entrance building as offices. It was different, but it still looked something like a film studio. At least it did until Polycell left town and the entire site was bulldozed. Sad as it is that Welwyn Studios is no more, it's wonderful so many terrific monuments to it remain. Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, Last Holiday starring Alec Guinness, Peter Ustinov's Private Angelo, all owe something to the Garden City Film Hub. And then there's Brighton Rock, a picture set on the coast, shot in Welwyn Garden City, and loved by everyone. Everyone, that is, except for Richard Attenborough's brother. While interviewing Sir David in 2003, I was surprised to hear that he didn't particularly care for the film or his brother's latest study of a psychopath in 10 Rillington Place. "It's very hard for me," he explained. "I love my brother very much and I've no desire to see him playing a craven murderer." Oh, and in case you're wondering which of Dickie's films David does love, Gandhi, of course, is a work of genius, and who doesn't love The Great Escape? To which the answer is nobody, although it plays even better when seen on a double bill with Brighton Rock, a film with Welwyn Garden City running all the way through it.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to all our contributors, including our readers, Elizabeth, Jenny, Anna and Kelly. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme. But that's all from me, Bill Redway, in March 2019. We close with the Karavik Sisters and their track, Crate 223. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.